If you own a piece of property that doesn't have an address but has like a fancy name, Monticello, Montepillier, the Hermitage, you're an elitist, all right? You are an elitist if you live in a property that's known by a name.
Welcome back to The Buck Starts Here, the podcast that digs deep into the juicy stories, power plays, and wild twists that shape the presidencies of the United States. I'm Kyle, the non to Eric Mason's colonialization. It's actually a correction to go with that one, by the way. But if you've been following along with us, then you already know that Eric's flipped the script on its head for the start, since we've covered John Quincy Adams' life post and pre-presidency. So while we normally would be discussing ancillary characters and events, I'm guessing today we're going to talk about the actual presidency, baby?
Yeah, very much like John Quincy Adams. We're going super non-traditional. I think we're going to have a fun one today. I would like to submit humbly a name for this episode. John Quincy Adams was right. JQO was right, because he was right. He called everything in his presidency. He was just soothsayer.
You're not even talking about the Civil War stuff.
Oh no, he already predicted that. He's like, oh yeah, There's gonna be a Civil War,
right?
Be over this issue.
Before you get too far into that, good job teasing the upcoming content, by the way. We do have a correction, as I hinted to with my little intro there. The non-colonialization that caused so much kerfuffle. I think that was Monroe 4 episode. I just finished editing it, and I can't wait to share you that short I made.
Is that
out
gonna
of
be
it
a short?
Oh god, yeah, it's so good.
I might have to pull. I might have to hack into the YouTube channel to delete that.
Can't wait to show you that. But no, that what's hilarious is that the actual word was what you were trying to say first. It was non-colonization, not non-colonialization. Laura was doing the text overlays, and she went and pulled the actual speech. She's like, oh wait, he was right the first time.
I am convinced my bad. The AI that translates my dialogue in particular is going to be the one that rises up to take over humanity. It's going to deem humanity unable to function based on how I talk.
The one that figures out how you talk is the one that's going to tell us what the whales are saying. Finally,
I was on another YouTube channel a little while ago, and one of the comments was, "I like listening to Eric talk because he sounds like he's using a voice augmenter, and it makes me feel like what he's telling me is a secret."
I love that comment.
Fun thing: my voice sounds very high pitched in my head.
Like, does it?
Yeah, so like right now I can hear my voice on my microphone feeding back in.
And oh, so that doesn't mess you up?
No, not really. So that's what causes a stutter. I had a stutter and a speech impediment growing up, and I did a lot of speech therapy. So I don't know if I just naturally hear my own voice doesn't mess me up, but no.
It's the delay. It's that little like half second delay that, oh man, that'll really throw me off when I try to talk.
Yeah, I do, unfortunately, enough public speaking where I'm used to being in front of a mic that doesn't bother me that much anymore. One more thing before we jump in, Kyle, I just want to remind our lovely fan base about journaling. did we get any emails? Actually, that episode hasn't gone live. I don't know why I asked that.
Yet. No.
I do not understand the world of production is what basically
our production schedule is so weird, because I'm over here commenting on an episode that came out 3 weeks ago because we're just now recording the next batch. Like, we record these in batches, so it might be a couple episodes before stuff gets
brought up. We're not supposed to tell them that, right?
I feel like you can let them in, right?
This that scares me.
Probably all going to get cut anyway, so it's not like it really matters.
But no, anybody who's interested, you know, email us. We're giving away 10. We're giving away 10 journals, so you can start journaling. They're going to be branded. We're going to mail them out to you. I'll put a nice little note in there. And no, we're going to reach out the first 10 people to email us at. Kyle, I still forget our email address.
Buck starts here. podcast@gmail.com.
Yes, the lack of confidence in your voice scared the crap out of me.
Yeah, because I can't remember if I had the podcast to do it. Yes, it's buckstartsherepodcast@gmail.com.
Yeah, we'd reach out to us, and we are going to bring you on air. By Kyle and I deciding, I mean I'm going completely unilateral here and saying, you know, we're going to make you come back a year from now and read all your deepest, darkest secrets if you get one of these.
Yes. All right. Now, speaking of journaling and why we know so much about our upcoming subject here, why don't you kick us off with the presidency of John Quincy Adams?
Oh, the presidency of John Quincy Adams. So it starts with the election of 1824. with the corrupt bargain, which we will be diving deeper into later on, the last episode of John Quincy Adams series is going to be on the corrupt bargain and how it wasn't corrupt and it wasn't a bargain. And it was just Andrew Jackson being salty and a child. I don't care that Andrew Jackson, if he came back and beat me up, I will stand by that. That man is just perpetually angry.
Without a stick? If he didn't have a stick, do you think he could?
I don't know, man. He seems like a tough guy. Even though, like, every major battle he fought in, not every major battle, but his two battles he's known for, was basically him defeating an army on the other side of its supply routes, whatever you call it, after war was already over. And the other one was them just essentially raiding villages. So I don't know. He gets his,
it's like Native American villages.
Yeah, he's like, I'm a man of the common people. It's like, yeah, you're a man of like not actually accomplishing that much militarily. And I'm sure there's still people who love Jackson for some reason. I mean, there's still people who love Jefferson. I get the Jefferson more than the Jackson one, but that episode's gonna be horrible. And it's the whole series, not the corrupt bargain episode. The me having to talk honestly about Jackson is gonna test my patience. we're gonna try and take an objective look at Jackson, but I will start this off with saying he should not be on the $20 bill.
Look, the only thing that we promise to be objective on is the scoring and the ranking systems.
We promise.
Oh no, wait,
that's
backwards.
No. Oh my god.
So I feel like we've been pretty objective.
We did better during Jefferson than I thought we were gonna. Yeah. Like I went back and listened to that and I was like, oh, Laura edited this, or Kyle, whichever one you edited it.
Oh, Laura
definitely
did that
made
one.
Us seem way less, or me seem way less unhinged about this dude. So it starts the election of 1824. All right, so at this time, John Quincy Adams, he was the Secretary of State under James Monroe. And what had happened in the previous several elections is the Secretary of State was kind of seen as the predecessor position to the presidency. So the Secretary of State...
Why not the Vice President? It always seems like that should be the natural stepping stone, but VP always seems like it's been like the place where politicians kind of go to die.
Well, I guess you could... Jefferson was Secretary of State prior, but he wasn't Secretary of State immediately prior to becoming president. But John Quincy Adams' father, John Adams, kind of destroyed that as a stepping stone because of the lack of being able to talk in the Senate. You were just sitting around waiting to become president if something bad happened. Didn't have a lot of policy discretion. We have a very weak vice presidency in our Constitution. I don't know if that's intentional. There's a lot of scholarly writing on why we have a weak VP.
I mean, initially it was like just the runner-up. So, I mean, it would make sense that you didn't want to give too much power to your political opponent initially. But, I mean, that could have changed over years too.
Yeah, no, that's a good take. Now, what's funny, a funny relation between both John Adams and John Quincy Adams were the only of the first six presidents to not win re-election. They were also the only two to have a vice president turn against them. So Jefferson famously turned against Adams, and John C. Calhoun turned against John Quincy Adams during their administration. So we have the election of 1824. And we're not going to get too much into this episode, but it ends up getting this. It's the only election ever decided by the House in terms of the House actually having to vote. Now, as we'll learn in the next episode, each state votes. And what happened in this election is Jackson wins the popular vote. He wins, but it's like 155,000 to Adams' 110,000.
That's pretty significant margin, actually.
Yeah, it is. But remember, the Electoral College decides the presidency.
Right.
And at this point in time, the Adams gets 84 Electoral College votes. Jackson gets 99. Again, we'll get to more of the episode, but we're going to tease the next episode where that's a very bad demonstration of the election of 1824. It has a lot to do with a certain compromise made in the Constitution. But we'll leave that for next episode. I don't want to burn all my material on Kyle right now. So Adams shows up 1825. He gives his State of the City or the address to Congress, and he lays out a bunch of really interesting points. He starts talking about what his vision for the country is, and what many of the things he brings up are things that, you know, to be honest with you, sounds, I think most modern contemporaries would say, you know, this sounds good. He talks about investing in a national highway.
Oh, I love that.
he has the Army Corps of Engineers start surveying different areas, survey out west. You know, one of the many things he talks about is government investment in industry, government investment in allowing, you know, the means of economic production to basically start gathering steam. You got to understand, John Quincy Adams is from the birthplace of the American Industrial Revolution, right? He's from Eastern Massachusetts. And so he's seen, for the last 30 years, 40 years of his life, he's seen the value of, you know, machinery and production. He right. proposes a national university, a naval academy, and a national astronomical observatory.
Wow. He got all that stuff done in his presidency?
No, he got none of those things done in his presidency. literally none of them. He did get a highway built to Ohio. He did construct various canals, and you know, he had this idea, and this is actually Henry Clay's idea, but it was championed by him, and it was something called the American system. It was this idea that we're making all this money off selling land out west, and mm-hmm. we should take this money and invest it in these, you know, sustainable public institutions, like a university, like a naval academy, like an astronomical observatory. And as an economist, one thing we talk about is the resource curse, all right? Yes. Why do areas that have so many natural resources fail, while other areas with so many natural resources succeed? And I say this as somebody who studied economics in the resource curse capital of the United States, which is West Virginia. Right. So I think this is important to understand John Quincy Adams' thoughts, because John Quincy Adams was just thinking ahead of the time. You know, he was the first president elected outside of his father, who saw no constitutional qualm about federal leadership on building roads, canals, and other institutions. So why is, like, South Dakota benefiting from, you know, shale fracking and natural gas and other hydrocarbons, and West Virginia is still struggling to deal with that? If you have the institutions already developed, so if you have a public education system, if you have infrastructure, if you have all these other things, and you suddenly have a windfall and you find all these natural resources, you already have the system in place to take these resources and reinvest them into an education system, into job training, into infrastructure, right? So you're benefiting from that because there's a system already in place to tax it. That's Celtic.
So it's you need the actual systems that the money would be going to already in place, not just the means to be able to collect the taxes and as a revenue. That was a misunderstanding I think I had on that when you first brought that up.
Yeah, and if you don't have those in place, you inherently become an extractive economy mm-hmm. where the marginal social cost or the cost
right.
imputed that's not expressed in price is borne by the people in the state or the country. And what's funny is we have a term for this, which is Dutch disease. And it's this idea that once you have an extractive resource without proper management of funds, it actually weakens the various industries that exists in your country that don't service that industry. And by weakening that, it makes you more reliant on that resource and therefore more susceptible to economic turmoil in it. And then when you finally run out of that resource or you have to diversify, you've drained all the other sectors. And Adams saw this. Adams was like, wait a minute, this is what's going to happen in the United States. Eventually, we're going to run out of land to sell. So why don't we take all those proceeds and make people smarter, make our military stronger, and start diversifying across other industries. And the Jacksonians got together and were like, nerd. I'm not joking. They literally were like, nerd. People started referring to his National Astronomical Observatory as, oh, what are you going to be looking at? It's going to be a bunch of lighthouses in the sky.
You know who needs to know about stars? Anybody on the freaking ocean. That's who.
I was going to say, Navy? Yes. Kyle, can I get your hot take finding out that Congress voted down, the Jacksonians voted down the Naval Academy?
That's where the officers come from?
Yeah.
Good.
That's what they said. I'm not joking. They said they were one of the criticisms. And you can see this. Like, I have all newspapers referenced here, my backup for this. And they were like, oh, it's going to create this elitism of like, oh, it's going to produce competent Navy guys.
It make us all look bad.
And I don't know why, just something about that just absolutely kills me. That they were like, what do we want, good guys being able to pilot ships? It's funny to me because the people against this was Andrew Jackson's guys. And Andrew Jackson was definitely an elitist. He owned slaves. He had the Hermitage. If you own a piece of property that doesn't have an address but has like a fancy name, Monticello, Montpelier, the Hermitage, you're an elitist. All right, you are an elitist if you live in a property that's known by a name. I will defend
that. Like Peacefield.
What's up?
Like Peacefield.
Like Peacefield. Yes. But if it got named after he was a president. You get to name your estate after you're a president. Am I being a hypocrite here? Yes, I am.
No.
But I will say John Quincy Adams, middle class when he was born. All right.
So my guess is their actual disdain for the Naval Academy would be the fact that anybody could join, and they probably didn't want commoners being able to be at the in the elite class.
Oh, I could definitely see that, because John Quincy Adams, who's famously aloof, would just have been like,
they're just like us. All just like us.
Yeah, you're probably also asking, hey, Eric, how come you're not going through his cabinet?
No, I was going to ask about that, actually.
Because I would just be repeating his cabinet under Monroe. He kept virtually everybody over. He kept the Navy Secretary, Samuel Southard. He kept the Attorney General, William Wirt. Oh my God, the alliteration on these people. He kept...
Dick Rush?
Dick Rush, yeah. Richard nice. Rush as Treasurer Secretary.
How about the Postmaster Generals? All three of those great names.
He did bring in Henry Clay as a Secretary of State, which was his previous position, and John C. Calhoun stuck around as VP.
Really?
Yeah. So a lot of people, actually at the time, a lot of people complimented.
Monroe might have been the best president.
I genuinely think it took literally probably the most evil man becoming president and just making stuff up. And him refusing to campaign because John Quincy Adams never slung mud back at Andrew Jackson. Unlike his dad. Yeah. His dad had given a tit for tat with Jefferson. He was just like, this is beneath the president. You need to respect the office. You have every right. Like, his whole thing was like, you have every right to mock me as your president. Like, he was like, that's a fundamental freedom.
So he'd have been a fan of the White House Press Correspondents Dinner?
Oh, he would have.
He'd have been a huge fan of that.
Would he have gotten the jokes? No. But would he have been a fan of it? Yes.
He'd have been sitting there not laughing at anything, but then this, they did a good job.
Yeah. No, people seem to be enjoying this. So, yeah, he's ahead of his time, right?
Yeah.
Interstate Highway Act would be 130 years later. The Naval Academy, you know, that was like 20 years later in 1845. But the Department of the Interior was something he proposed. And that wouldn't come around until 1849. So he proposed a national university, which we still don't have, but you could argue the land grant universities are our national universities, right? Says the guy who went to a very large land grant university.
How many of those are there?
There's one for every state.
Yeah. So that's what the state, like ASU or... Okay, so that's what the state college is.
Yeah, I'm not sure if ASU is the land grant. It probably is, but basically you had the Morris Act, which allowed land to be sold to fund state universities, and so that's how you end up with, you know, different systems around the country. Now, even systems that weren't funded directly through the Morris land grant bills and stuff like that, they still echo a similar obligation within those states. So, like, West Virginia University is the preeminent land grant university in West Virginia. But, you know, 2025, is it funded in the same way? No, it's but it's still that flagship university. So like the UMass system, the SUNY system, the Cal system. These are all products of essentially this idea that federal government should come in and sponsor universities. But I think a little different than what Adams was saying, we still end up with it. We still end up with every state has a place where its citizens get a crazy discount to go have like really, really high-end education. Look at our land grant universities. They're R1 rated, which is the top research standard. If you look globally, if you look at universities all across the world, what you end up finding out is that most of the elite universities in the world are public, American public universities. So John Quincy Adams, after the idea of the national university failed in Congress, he still pushed for this idea. He pushed for greater education. His whole idea was that, you know, we're going to get a greater investment with an educated workforce, and that as we're making all this money from the sales of the lands out west, we can reinvest that into a national university and then be able to have a next generation. This would not be funded through debt. This would not be funded by an increase in taxation. This would be taking a resource, land, that is finite and fleeting, and converting it into something sustainable, like a national university. And while we never saw his idea, we did see it eventually come about land-grant colleges. Then there was his idea of the Department of the Interior, which again got voted down, wouldn't be founded 20 years later. But he said, we should really have a department that oversees America's infrastructure and internal developments. And everybody was like, that's a dumb idea.
Why seems like a great idea. Why do you have such a hard time convincing people to do anything? Is it just politics of the day? Or is he just not that good of explaining his ideas? Was he not that good of a consensus builder?
What's funny about that is he was actually described as very eloquent and was very good at explaining his ideas. The problem was the Jacksonian Democrats fought him every step of the way. And at the midterm elections in 1826, basically they lost complete control over Congress. And Congress took great efforts to thumb its nose at Adams, especially after the Panama Congress affair, where Adams wanted to send a representative to the Panama Conference to align himself with, you know, the newly freed states, countries in South America that were that already banned slaves. They actually did end up sending a delegate, and the delegate died on his way.
Oh, no.
But it was after the conference. It was too late to go to the conference. The Senate voted.
Still.
He did have some success in the first 2 years. So he did build, he built the Chesapeake and Ohio canals, and the Chesapeake and Delaware Canal Road. He built a highway through Ohio.
When you say through Ohio, where did that start?
Think of it like tributaries from the East Coast coming through.
Pretty substantial. I mean, that's a pretty good chunk of distance to cover with roads.
Yeah. And, you know, he also, in 1826, he also welcomed, you know, railroads. The first railroad in the United States was in Quincy, Massachusetts, for the record. Yeah, there you go. Go visit it. It's still a monument.
Was that just for moving, freight and stuff around?
Moving granite up an incline. You could run up in a minute. You can see what it looks like. It's kind of cool looking.
That's awesome.
And so Baltimore, the B&O Railroad, the Baltimore and Ohio Railroad, was the first real passenger, U.S. passenger railway that opened up in 1826. And Adams loved it. He was like, this is the future.
He's a train guy, huh?
Yeah, he's a train guy. Now, there was a lot. I want to put it to where things went south. And to be honest with you, there's not a lot after this in his presidency. So, unfortunately, Mr. Kyle, I don't think we have much of a dance left after this. Uh-huh. But I think it's a cool thing that really shows the character of John Quincy Adams and why he was right about everything. There was something called the Treaty of Indian Springs. And it was when a faction of what we now call the Creek Nation. Historians at this time frame call it like the Muskogee. There's a couple other names get thrown around. But anyways, I think Creek is the most proper way to describe it today. Honestly, start off in the comments too.
Yeah,
if I'm wrong about that. Yep. I would actually really like to know if anybody, especially anybody who belongs to that nation, could explain why I see three or four different names. I don't know if it's a regional thing and they're all part of one nation.
Can we get
1820s historians?
Can we get a Creek historian? Fun bonus episode with that.
Yeah, that's one of those things I find really interesting. I can't really trust 1820s writers. I don't want to trust them on the proper name. Somebody who reads a lot of this stuff, some of the names I've seen put out there are not names you should repeat in polite company. I think Creek, when I read contemporary historians, they are very adamant. They say Creek, but they also then qualify with what I just said. So it's not helping anybody. they were led by this guy, Chief William McIntosh. And he decided to sell virtually all the Creek land to the state of Georgia. Mm-hmm. And it's funny because all the Creeks are like, dude, what are you doing? And they hated the agreement. It was clearly, had no broad consent. He had no authority to do this based on their structure. Again, somebody correct me on the cheap structure, but again, reading a lot of guys and, you know, trying to do the most honest interpretation of this, is basically he didn't, in his authority as chief, actually didn't have this authority to sell land. It wasn't part of his, political power, I guess you would call it that.
Yeah, but I don't think anybody in or whoever on the other side of that probably didn't really care. They were just trying to find anybody who'd sign something.
Oh, no. Governor Troop, George Troop, was the governor of Georgia at the time. He was very happy this was happening, and he did not care what the powers were. Right. So Adams gets into office and is faced with this treaty. And he did something that was considered unprecedented at the time. Not just like kind of at the time, even to this day, I think would be considered wild. Because this is a, people are like, this is a state issue. It's amazing how many times the argument, this is a state issue, at this point in history, is just like double talk for something else. Something very bad. So Adams stepped in and nullified the treaty.
Really?
And yep, and he negotiated a new treaty. It was called the Treaty of Washington in 1826, so about a year afterwards. And it restored some of the Creek lands, basically the Creek lands that had to do with the survival of the Creek. But yeah. Again, I think a Creek historian would be great to clear this out. Like, we did get this from an encyclopedia. Like, this isn't from, this isn't like broad speculation. Like, the, and I'm talking about the Treaty of Washington. A lot of this stuff's an amalgamation of, you know, different sources. But like, the Treaty of Washington is directly from an encyclopedia. Cause I was like, I just want a very bland, direct answer to what this is.
Did Mr. John Quincy Adams write about this in his journal? Do we have any of his thoughts on it?
I'll get to what he wrote about it in a second.
Okay.
So he nullifies the treaty. He renegotiates the treaty. A good chunk of land goes back to the Creek, like the land they used to survive, all that stuff. Governor Troup refuses to recognize the treaty and actually mobilizes the state militia to seize those Creek lands back and starts surveying them for white settlement. So then Adams is like angered by this because he's like, I'm the federal government. You don't do that to me. Actually threatened to send U.S. troops to enforce the treaty and protect the Creek's rights. Mm-hmm. And it causes this huge standoff in 1826, and they're prepared to fight the U.S. Army rather the Georgia troops are going to fight the U.S. Army. And unfortunately, at the end, Adams ends up not pursuing a battle because Congress at this point has just lost it. I mean, they are just ripped. They don't want to deal with this. They already didn't like Adams because they viewed him like kind of as an elitist. Which again is ironic because he was probably one of the poorer guys walking around, or at least he made his money off his own work as opposed to, you know, enslaving human beings. Right. And he backed down. And he did that because Congress would never authorize the use of the U.S. Army in this case.
Yeah, I mean, the Constitution pretty strictly forbids the use of troops in home territory, right?
There was no law really? That existed. Really? Yeah, that's a surprisingly modern law. The Posse Comitatus Act. Yep, and that was 1878.
So is this, I mean, you said this is the point where everything kind of starts to go off the rails for him or his presidency. Yeah. Is it just because Jackson hated the Native Americans and anybody who'd stand up to him just lost his mind?
Yeah, I mean, part of it is that. I mean, Andrew Jackson has a bizarre relation with Native Americans. I believe he adopted a Seminole as Andrew Jackson Jr., but like he's a very complicated man. And by very complicated man, I mean pretty straightforward evil. Yeah. It's not complicated. You're just a bad person.
I don't know why you.
I don't know why it's a complicated.
I appreciate you trying to be nice, but you don't have to.
No, Kyle, what this really comes down to is that state rights issue. And they were like, how dare a president come down here and is willing to enforce federal authority to protect Native Americans? Like that bothered people. And they basically, and this was by 1827, this is when most of them had moved westward. You had the midterm elections by this point. And then it was a bloodbath for what now were called National Republicans. National Republicans and Democrats are what we broke off to. I just want to be clear, not Democratic Party today. The embryo of the modern Democratic Party, certainly, but in the same vein that the Whigs are the modern day Republican Party. They don't really have to do that much with each other. They're all Democratic Republicans at this time. But two factions broke off, and you see the National Republicans, start kind of being like the Adamses and supporting those guys. And then you have the Democrats. And those are kind of where the Democratic Republican Party splits into two.
So you're saying the Democratic Republican Party split into a National Republican Party and a Democratic Party? And I was not right that that's how we got the two parties?
No, so the National Republicans you're broadly correct. That's where the word Republican from.
I said I made a short on that and you lit me up on it.
No, but it's because it's like not, but I'm being semantic and you can yell at me. Like, the Republican Party is this abolitionist party that was formed as an offshoot to the Whigs. And the Whig Party was relatively, I wouldn't say ineffective, but it wasn't. I mean, it was effective, don't get me wrong, but it wasn't as long-lasting. The Democratic Party right now, that term being used, they didn't call themselves Democratic Party. They called themselves Democrats. they were just using the first part of that name, and they were saying, we like democracy. Obviously, they're looking at Andrew Jackson, who, you know, got the popular vote and lost. And then they're like, oh, well, you know, then you have Adams, who believes in the supremacy of the federal government, the republic, and they just split like that. It would be a, like, you go National Republicans, they fall off, they don't exist anymore. Whigs come along, and then you have the Republican Party. So I guess that's why I was being pedantic.
No, that makes sense.
God's like, I'm going to punch you next time I see you. I'm right.
But I do want to ask, do political parties follow the same vein as like country names, where like the more Democratic and Republican sounding the name, the more authoritarian it is?
No, usually not. Okay. I've always loved that one. Right? The more the country's trying to convince you it's free, the less
Democratic
free the
People's Republic of North Korea. Yeah,
like, there's a country called totalitarianism, and it's just like a libertarian paradise. No, so it's but at this point we're pretty much at the end of Adams's effective ability to govern, and I think it really comes down to two individuals that epitomizes both. And I'm not actually throwing flack at these two guys. I just really think it really echoed the shift that occurred. It wasn't just like 1826 midterms happen, a bunch of new people are elected who don't like Adams, because Jackson's essentially been campaigning since the end of the election. 3 months after he loses the election of 1824, Jackson is nominated as a candidate for president from Tennessee. Mm-hmm. They literally nominated him 3 months. He campaigned for 3 years. But in particular, a Tennessee senator named Thomas Hart Benton, and there was a New York editor, Francis Preston Blair, excellent name, who were great. It's a great example because one was a senator, one was a very prominent editor. They were always open to working with Adams. They were always like, hey, I'm a Jackson guy, but I like your ideas. You're very U.S. focused. We like that a lot. They became ardent Jackson men, not even wanting to, you know, deal with anything with Adams. And I think that's a good metaphor for that poisoning that occurred. And at this point, John C. Calhoun started, honestly, he was just very open in the Jackson camp. And you know, he viewed himself as a person who was going to succeed Jackson. He was kind of I don't want to say he was like in a competition with Martin Van Buren, but definitely similar. Mm-hmm. It ended, you know, Martin Van Buren. Oh, one thing I forgot to add, and we'll talk about next episode. Jackson actually leaves the Senate after he loses. He's so upset. But by this point, Martin Van Buren and honestly Calhoun have galvanized against the president to such a point that we end up with a stalemate throughout 1827 and 1828. We go into the election of 1828. It's horrible. It's mudslinging. A lot of the stuff they just made up about Adams. And then Adams refused to counteract it. They painted him as this, you know.
I think I remember actually learning about this in school. Was this like the first like real like mudslinging? And I think I remember them talking about how he wouldn't engage in it. And that was kind of like the downfall of why he lost the election.
Yep. He viewed it beneath the president. He didn't like the idea of a president slandering somebody. But all this weird stuff came out. And since we're going to talk about the election of 1824, next episode, election of 1828 is interesting because Jackson's throwing all this mud and he's not getting involved. Jackson had a bad habit of executing members of the military. Like, he would execute deserters. And there's a lot of evidence that shows he was executing deserters who weren't tried.
Right.
And he executed a lot of Native Americans at the time. So there was a very famous picture from a Philadelphia editor who was a very pro-Adams called Coffin Handbills, which graphically depicted and condemned Jackson's summary executions of deserters and Native Americans through all throughout his career. And it's funny because Jackson flipped out and retaliated and just made stuff up. I'm going to read directly a quote on this. Jackson made up a accusation that, you know, claimed that Adams, while ambassador to Russia in earlier years, had procured an American girl for the Tsar's pleasure. Which is just like the most anti-Adams thing in the world. And there was a hatred of Tsar Nicholas I by Americans, because one of the cool things that went through Adams' presidency was that there wasn't that much international turmoil, because Adams had, the joke at the time is Adams had solved many of the international crises when he was Secretary of State, so there's nothing. Right. And he did a lot of unilateral trade because he was allowed to negotiate it. And he made, you know, he actually at one point like embargoed British ships from U.S. ports, and this is in 1827. And this, everybody's like, oh, this is gonna be, you know, this is gonna be like what Jefferson did, and all this stuff. But Adams ends up negotiating this reciprocal trade agreement with all these smaller nations like Denmark, Sweden, Norway, Austria, Brazil, tons of these new Central American nations. And what's funny is, like, the U.S. ends up basically having a deal brokered. Mm-hmm. The Treaty of Ghent that ended the War of 1812. They end up, like, brokering a deal with the Brits to actually, for the U.S. to be compensated for all the damages that Britain did to the U.S. And it was negotiated by Tsar Nicholas I. And I think it's hilarious that they were like, oh, well, the Tsar, he, instead of being like, oh, John Adams, you know, John Quincy Adams served twice in Russia, knows how the courts work, and came up with a very reasonable diplomatic mission, the Tsar comes and negotiates. We get all our money that we lost in the War of 1812. You know, the war that Andrew Jackson didn't fight, an actual battle that mattered in? And we got repaid by the Brits for all the stuff we did. Oh, it must be because John Quincy Adams did this unscrupulous thing for the Tsar. Instead of being like, maybe he's a good negotiator and isn't a jerk and is right. able to figure out processes. But what ended up happening is every time the Jackson camp tries to, like, make something up, mm-hmm. it's very comical. It ends up inadvertently coming back around because, well, they were talking about this, you know, horrible accusation about this alleged gift for the Tsar. Somebody was like, Andrew Jackson, your wife's already married. It's just, like, big thing. Because Rachel Jackson was committing bigamy. She had divorced her husband prior, but never... it wasn't final or anything. It's funny because Jackson's like, that shouldn't count. They're like, no, you made up one thing, but, like, we have marriage licenses. Like, your wife was married. No divorce papers yet. Here's right. your marriage date. What are you doing here, brother? And unfortunately, Rachel Jackson ends up dying. And Andrew Jackson blames it from the stress of the election of 1828. By this point, you know, it's kind of a foregone conclusion. Jackson's gonna win. Yeah. They passed these tariffs in May of 1828. So, you know, they're called the Tariffs of Abomination. And they were these super high tariffs that Congress passed, Senate passed, that would increase all tariffs to about 45%. And it was meant to, you know, create this, you know, impossible position for Adams, because Adams was modern on tariffs. Mm-hmm. He saw them as political tools.
I'd have seen him as wanting free trade, removing barriers to trade.
Yeah, he was. That's how I would describe him, to be honest. But
yeah.
I think he saw tariffs as a useful political tool. So in early 1828, Van Buren and the other pro-Jackson members of Congress, they introduced this, like, crazy high tariff bill, you know, and it was really, you know, for raw materials, and that was to appease, like, some of the electorate that's out western part of the United States, which is like Tennessee and Kentucky yeah. and Ohio at this time, and manufactured goods like British woolens, which was to really help to get the New Englanders involved. And they expected the New England Adams supporters to join the Southern free trade advocates to defeat the bill. And this would embarrass Adams. But it backfired because the high tariff alliance held and Congress ended up passing the tariffs in 1828. So, like, they thought this was going to get defeated. And then, so Adams finds himself in this, like, weird dilemma. He either has to sign the tariff bill with even stricter than he wanted or veto it and have no tariffs at all. And in the end, he approved the tariffs. And you know, it was just him kind of accepting the reality that this is better than not having it. But the fallout was crazy. So mm-hmm. immediately, 45% tariffs on everything. And the northern manufacturing loves it. They're like, oh, this is great. This is like, we have no competition. Right. The south almost collapses. I mean, they start freaking out, higher prices to import. Then there's, you know, retaliation on exports from the country. Like, you know, people think the Brits are going to go after him. And then, you know, one southerner actually calls it, he's the guy who names it, this tariff abomination. You know, then Vice President Calhoun goes in and he flips out and actually pens something called the South Carolina Exposition and Protest, laying out the doctrine of nullification. So we see nullification appear again of him trying to veto a federal law. And the, you know, poetically, you know, the tariff controversy kind of did sail Adams' faith in the South. But it really kind of showed us what we were going to expect under Jackson, which is this really no plan, just doing stuff to be petty and tick everybody off. And as 1828 ends, and as we go into his lame duck, we really don't see anything crazy. But in the last moment, the last fading glimpse of John Quincy's presidency, he cannot help but be the consummate American first president that he does not get credit for this day about. And I want to fill you in on his last thing he did as president. So in 1828, Justice Trimble of the Supreme Court dies, and Adams nominates John C. Crittenden to the court in December of 1828. But the Jacksonian Senate refuses to confirm the appointment during the lame duck, and they prefer to leave the seat for Jackson to fill. And a lot of people basically saw that as like the last kick to Adams. But the beauty that is Adams, he remarks of how he thought that, well, it was his duty to appoint it, that he was, in fact, the lame duck. And it was the right thing that the incoming elected president does hold the right to nominate a Supreme Court justice. And I'm just like, that is such an awesome Adams. Like, wow. Oh, no, you can't defeat the man. He's too moral. Like, he's like, no, you're right. Like,
yeah, that's your prerogative. You are well within your rights to do that.
Yeah, but
wow. You know,
your president's favorite president. There's simply nothing not to like about John Quincy Adams. You can dislike John Adams. He's a salty guy, but John Quincy Adams would be a good president at any age.
I mean, he's probably going to have to get dinged a little bit for not being able to pass anything, but
that'll be next episode. Highway Act.
That's true. That's true. To Ohio.
I'm giving him sevens on everything. He's going to be on Mount Rushmore forever.
All right. Well, that's going to be the end for part three, but you can join us next week as we wrap up our profile on John Quincy Adams. In the meantime, you can reach out, tell us your favorite John Quincy Adams non-presidential moments. You can do that in the comments or by emailing us at buckstartsherepodcast@gmail.com. On your way out, visit the website at buckstartsherepodcast.com to browse our growing back catalog. Hit that subscribe button on your favorite platform, and we'll see you all next week. Produced by China Shop Productions.